there. Okay, so in case you were all so sad that last week was only one parsha, well, good news. We got another double portion again this week. It's tough. We covered so much Torah material in the last 5-6 weeks. It's just, But the good news is that once we get to the next book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, it slows down a little bit. But this week we finish and conclude the third book of the Torah, known as Vayikra. And the two last portions are known as Bahar and Bechukotai. Those are the names of the parashiyot. And what I'd like to do is focus more on the first one than the second. Bahar really has, for the most part, one major theme to it. And it introduces us to the laws, what we in English will refer to as the sabbatical year, Shemitah in Hebrew. The Shemitah, the sabbatical year, is one of the most beautiful mitzvot that is even performed today. Even though certain aspects of it are hard to employ, but it is in many, many cases still done. You say, well, what is it? Well, the law is as follows. The Torah tells us that every seventh year, we are to not plant, we are not to actively help, nurture, cause things to grow in our fields during that entire 12-month period. During that entire year, known as the sabbatical year, a farmer, for all intents and purposes, is unemployed. It seems like a very difficult law. I mean, imagine if you turn to a doctor, you turn to a lawyer, you turn to a teacher. Well, teacher's not a good example because, you know, the three main reasons why a person goes into teaching is June, July, and August. But for everybody else, go ahead and say, you know what? Take off an entire year. Well, how am I going to earn? I don't know. It's a good question, but you figure it out. Go for it, buddy.
Didn't we do that this year?
Yeah.
Right. We all did.
Many people, that is true. Now the U.S. government was kind enough to help us get through, but it's a good point because, listen, let's again, what we're going to do is we're going to state the facts and then try to understand. The fact is, the Torah says, is that every farmer, there is no working the land. The land must grow, in English they call it grow fallow. There is no working the field. What grows on its own, you're welcome to take what you need. You cannot hoard it for yourself. It is open for anyone. A poor person, somebody passing through, anybody has the rights to take it. You are entitled to what you need for you and your family, but that's it. There's no earning a profit off of it. The field must be let go. It's called Shemitah, sabbatical year. That takes up a large portion of Parshas Bahar. However, towards the end, it introduces us to a second connected, associated commandment, and that is known as the Jubilee year, the 50th. And yes, for those of you who have been married long enough, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It is a cause of celebration. What it is the Torah tells us that when you count seven sabbatical cycles, meaning you count 6 years and then you have the Shemitah, the sabbatical year, that's called one round. You do it a second, 6 more years, 7th year is sabbatical. You do this 7 times such that year 49 would be a 7, right? That would be the multiple. That would be a sabbatical year. And then the following year, year number 50, once again, has many laws similar to the sabbatical, and you are not to work the field yet again. So it's not just telling the guy take a year off. You're telling him to take 2 years off. Okay, now we're dipping into savings. This is getting hard now. This is not simple. Oh, but you say, okay, when that second year, year 50 is over, oh, good, we can eat. Well, what grew? You haven't worked the field in 2 years. You're first going to start planting now. So you're telling me that for 2+ years, I have no source of income. How's that going to fly with the people? hey, Moses comes down and says, man, have I got a deal for you? I can just see the people. Oh, this is great. Oh, we're supposed to have Shabbat. Oh, I like that idea. We're not supposed to be workaholics. Oh, that's a good one, Moses. Give me another one. Oh, we should be careful with our diet and eat only certain. Okay, I get that. Not fun. And how about giving charity? Oh, that's a nice one. And being kind. Oh, this is good. And give up your income for 2+ years. I'm sorry. Come again. What did you just say? Like you're sneaking that one in, right? Who's paying attention at the end of the book of Leviticus? Like nobody's paying attention anymore. You just throw that one in, right? Chas v'shalom, heaven forbid. No, no, no. This is one of the most fundamental principles of the Torah. Think about it. What is it that God wants to convey to us that we should not be working and supporting our families? What is it he's trying to tell us? Not 1 year, but potentially 2+ years. This is
he'll provide.
He'll take care of us. He'll provide for us.
God will provide.
Follow the Torah. Do.
Yeah. If when your son-in-law came to date your daughter, and you asked that very important question of, so you want to take her out and how are you going to support her? Because we want her off the payroll sooner rather than later. And he says, and he looks you square in the eye and he says, I don't really have a plan, but God will provide. How happy did that make you?
Except for we had 6 years, and then the seventh year, God provided. And that happened seven times in a row. So it's not like he said right off the bat, 2 years, you had seven cycles to get ready for it.
So what you're telling
me, 2 years.
So what I'm hearing from you is that there's a good track record here. God has shown that it works. This isn't you're right. It wasn't right off the bat. Oh, by the way, as soon as we enter into the land of Israel, don't plant anything. Somehow, some way, everything's just going to miraculously be taken care of. We'd worked it for 6 years and then shown God made it happen miraculously that we were okay. But if you really think about it, and I know we spoke about it years ago, this mitzvah is one of the strongest pieces of evidence about the veracity of the Torah, that it must be true. Because imagine that they tried this. The Jewish people entered into the land of Israel and they went ahead and they worked for 6 years and they were asked to hands off. Well, they asked the obvious question, how are we going to survive? And the answer was, don't worry, God will take care of us. And it worked. Okay, maybe you got lucky the first time, Moses. 7 years later, let's try this again. Sure enough, year 14, here we go. And year 21, we have a track record. God shows that there's no record anywhere that the Jewish peoples died of starvation anytime there was a sabbatical. There's no such record of that. So it must be a proven winner. Okay. No human being would ever have the chutzpah. Well, that's not true. In today's political climate, there are candidates who would make such promises. But the normal, everyday, regular, run-of-the-mill person would not have the audacity to make a claim, don't worry, your crops in year 6 will be so plentiful that it'll cover year 6, 7, and even into 8. Nobody's going to say something like that because it's too risky. The first time it fails, the whole book is out the window. But that's one point. We're not going to talk about that tonight, but rather what Michelle is saying is that this was a test. This really, truly was a test of faith. How much do we truly believe, as it says on the dollar bill, in God we trust? Do we really? Or do I think, right here, baby, I did this. I made this happen. I grew it. I made it. I took care of it. And look what I got. Well, God says, I want to make sure that you understand that you had a partner. Yes, you worked on it. You tilled the soil. You planted. You harvested. You did everything. That's true. But I did have some part to do with it also, like rain, sunshine, the right nutrients, preventing cicadas from coming and eating everything. There is, God says, do you really truly believe that I'm a part of all of this? Let me see. Lift your hands up, let go, and see if you really can have faith that I will take care of you. It is not a simple mitzvah. We all think about it. I don't know, for certainly in the teaching profession, you're like a sabbatical. Man, I would kill for one of those. To have my company pay for me to go spend a year studying and going, sign me up. I already picked out my top three colleges I want to go study in. And they're not in the United States, right? But that's not what really a sabbatical is. A sabbatical was a tremendous test of faith. But here's where it gets interesting. The entire Parsha of Bahar really deals with, as I said, the sabbatical and the Jubilee years and the things associated with it. Until the last two sentences. The last two sentences. It's almost as if the Hollywood screenwriters wanted you to come back next week and you're already exhausted. The hero won the battle. It's everything's falling exactly into place. But you throw one curveball at the end so that you'll come. It almost sounds like that. We finish the entire topic. And then the last two sentences in the parsha say, you shall not make idols for yourself, and you shall not erect for yourselves a statue or a pillar. And in your land, you shall not emplace a flooring stone upon which to prostrate oneself. For I am Hashem, your God. No idol worshiping, no setup of stone floors that you're going to bow down on, nothing. I want nothing of that in my land. Not only that, last sentence, my Sabbaths shall you observe and my sanctuary shall you revere. I am Hashem. Thank you all for coming. Continued next week. What kind of ending is this? I've been talking to you for, imagine, I'm supposed to do this 45-minute class. It ends up being almost an hour every week. Imagine in minute 58, when I've pretty much wrapped it up, put a beautiful bow on it, and I say, oh, and I drop this bombshell of a question. I say, oh, it's a shame, time's running out. We got to move on. Next week, we can maybe talk about it. It just seems not connected at all with the parsha. Totally unrelated. And the truth be told, it's not even a continuation the following week. When you turn to the next parsha, we're on to something else. We're on to general blessings and curses, following God's commands, not following God's commands. This two ideas about idol worship and keeping the Shabbos and revering God's sanctuary seem to be completely nothing to do with what we're talking about. Moses was not getting paid by the sentence, and he just threw two in because he needed to make his quota. There's got to be something more to this.
Does it relate back to the experience with the golden calf because they didn't have faith? He's reminding them?
Could be, and that's only good for the second to last sentence. What about the last one? Shabbos?
Well, they didn't have faith in God, and had they observe the commandments, then they would not have done that. And keeping Shabbos is a commandment every week.
Okay, but that's only, you got 612 more to go.
Well, give them a break.
and revere my sanctuary. I know that's also a commandment. That's true. But so is kosher. Doesn't say, and observe my dietary laws. Doesn't say put on tefillin. Doesn't say put on a mezuzah. Those are all commandments. Why specify idol worship, Shabbos / the temple? It just seems
like they're interactions that man has with God or doesn't have with God if they were to worship idols.
I don't disagree, but can't you say that about, how about belief in God? How about don't use God's name in vain? There you go. That's in the top three. We can pick a lot. It almost sounds as if the Torah is identifying specifically idol worship and Shabbat / the temple. There must be something unique about those, and it somehow has to fit the theme of what we're talking about. Because again, and again, if you have a Chumash in front of you, you have the text in front of you, here's another little tidbit of trivia. It starts a new chapter. It starts a new chapter, those last two sentences.
One.
For those who may not be aware, chapters, right? In this particular case, the Parsha of Bahar starts chapter 25, and the last two sentences begin chapter 26. Chapters in the Torah is not a Jewish source. That was done much, much, much later by Christian scholars. They're the ones who put in chapter headings. It was not us. The Torah has no chapters. Yes, there are spaces between sections, as we've spoken, but it's not numbered chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3. This is another example of where the Christian scholars got it wrong, because it plays into my question even more. They recognize that it's unrelated to the previous part because it's a new chapter. In which case, why start a new chapter, give you two sentences, and then continue the chapter a week later? That doesn't make logical sense. So why is that? The answer is it's not. It shouldn't be a new chapter. It really is a continuation of our theme. I will tell you the following story, and you'll understand, I think, it will fit into place very, very quickly. Two litigants once came before the great revered Rabbi Chaim from Volozhin. He's known as Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner. He was the great student of the Vilna Gaon, the great leader in Europe. These two litigants came with a real estate dispute. They had an argument over the land. They showed him a certain field that each one claimed to be his own. After each man had explained animatedly and confidently why he felt the land was his, Reb Chaim stepped off to the side, bent his ear toward the ground for several seconds as if he were listening for something. When Reb Chaim returned, the assembled asked him what he had been doing. Listen to this. He responded that he wanted to hear the land's opinion on the matter. Well, everybody said, well, what did the earth say? Whose is it? Reb Chaim said, the land said, this one claims I am his, and this one claims I am his, but they're both wrong. They're both mine. We all end up there. We do not own this earth, ladies and gentlemen. God does. It is not our ownership. Yes, we have been given, here's the word, custodian. We are given custodial rights to use the land, but it is not ours. I don't care what the deed on your property says. It is not yours. It is not mine. It is God's. We begin the Torah not with the story of the formation of the Jewish people. It does not begin with the laws of do's and don'ts. It starts with creation of our universe by God. It belongs to God. Therefore, God says, no matter what it is you think you own, you do not. It is mine. There was a great scholar who looked and read the first couple of chapters in the Torah about creation, chapters 1 and 2. They present different perspectives. If you read it carefully, you'll see that chapter 1 and chapter 2 are talking at the exact same time, but they talk about from different perspectives. Maybe we'll analyze it one of these days. But he said the following. He said that the goal of the Torah, more than human theology, which is what people think about God, the Torah is really God's anthropology. It's God's eye view of human beings, of people. Think about that. Digest that for a minute. When you read the Torah, you think, I don't know about you, but I think that I'm gaining insights about God, which is true. But there's another perspective that we should look at it from. And that is when you read about God doing this, or man doing that, or God asking man to do something or not do something, we should be looking at it as the God's eye view of what he thinks of humanity, of what it is man can become. It's God's anthropology more than it is human theology. It's a deep thought, but I thought it really resonated with me. Being able to read. So you come to the story of creation. And what do you hear? What do you see in that story? You see that God created everything. And at the very end, he creates mankind. Adam and Eve. And he gives them two words for their entire mission statement. God places man in the Garden of Eden. And he tells him, your job, le'avda u'le'shamra, to work it and to guard it. That doesn't sound like mastery. That doesn't sound like, I now hand you the keys to the gates of the city. Go for it. Do with it as you please. Le'avda u'le'shamra means it's mine, and I'm putting you in charge to take care of it. But it's not yours. You're a hired hand. You know what your wages are? Life. I'll give you life. I'll give you prosperity. I'll give you health. I'll give you things that you need and want so that you can do your job properly. But it's not yours. Your job is to work it and to guard it. I think it's been a couple of months already, but we talked about the idea of the Jewish perspective on caring for the environment. This is the concept. It is not ours. It's our job to take care of it. The Talmud asks, why was man created last? You would think you start with the most important, you get that done, and then everything else is just secondary. You start at the top. The Talmud gives four reasons. Each one could be a class unto itself. But the first, I think the most obvious answer is that being the pinnacle of creation, you make sure that all the prerequisites are in place. You make sure your main actor or actress doesn't usually come on stage until all the props are set up, until the scene is all right. And then he or she makes their grand entrance. In a similar way, says the Talmud, that God had the world, the universe, all set up so that mankind can now be brought on stage to do his job. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. That's the simple understanding, and that's the first answer that the Talmud gives. However, the Talmud gives three other answers, the last of which I want to talk about, and I think it fits very nicely. But let me share with you numbers 2 and 3. Second reason the Talmud says is so that heretics, people who wish to deny, cannot claim that God had a partner in creation. Think about it. If man was the first creation, one mistakenly might have said, oh, look, what a great tag team. Now that man's on the scene, look what they created. All the beautiful trees and the fish and the animal. Look what they did. No, God was making sure there was no doubt about it. There's no person on the scene until the very end. I had no help, none whatsoever. It's an interesting answer because if you think about it, again, you have to take the time to think about it. Even though we were created in God's image, and not only that, we're charged with the responsibility of imitating God to the best of our ability, to be God-like, God put in a safety net to make sure that we never perceive ourselves as God. Maybe God-like. We strive to imitate the characteristics, try to incorporate those aspects of mercy, compassion, giving, loving, all these things that we try to imitate and incorporate, but we can never be God. And the safety feature is that we were the last of the creations. We cannot be God. That's answer number two, the Talmud says. But the third answer takes one more factor into account. And that is, it wasn't just the last creation. It was the last creation. And then we went into Shabbat. It was Friday afternoon. Why specifically then? Why didn't God create the world in 5 days and then, you know, Thursday afternoon create man? What is their connection? So the third answer says, because it was teaching man a very important lesson. And that is, now that you're on this earth, your focus should be, what is the immediate fulfilling a commandment? Go right into Shabbat. It was, see, had man been created on Thursday, I can guarantee you he would have been late to Shabbos. There's no question in my mind. Not even a question. He would have said, oh my gosh, I didn't know that the Ravens were on Thursday this week. And we watched football, sleep late Friday, realized he didn't go to the store yet. The Garden of Eden was closing. I thought, oh my God, I didn't go shopping yet. We would have done that. Therefore, God said, I'm going to create man on the eve of Shabbat so that he learns his lesson. Meaning, I'm saying it jokingly, obviously, but the point the Talmud is saying is a central message is, you're here, make it worthwhile. Don't lose your focus and going for a spatzir, going for a nice walk through the garden. And oh, isn't that a beautiful sunset? Oh no, sunset. Oh my God, it's Shabbos. Right. Go do what needs to get done. However, the fourth answer is really where we want to go with this. The fourth answer that the Talmud gives as to why man was not created at first, but was saved for the very last, quote, so the human being will enter immediately into the banquet, like a mortal king who builds the palace, sets the table, and only then invites in the guests of honor. God is the king. We are the guests. This is not our banquet. We are not the king. We are the guests of honor at this feast. If we go through life, understanding always through the viewpoint that I am a guest, we would do things very differently. The same way, if you were a guest in my home, how would you treat eating the food? Would you take three extra helpings and then say, after one, say, oh, my eyes were bigger than my stomach, and throw out the food? Would you go ahead? Would you look around and see how are people behaving? Would you take into consideration helping clear the table? You would do things a little differently. You would be much more sensitive. In your own home, you got your feet up. You clap your hands. You know, we think that our children are like the light, you know, clap on, clap off, right? Come here, kid, right? It's not how it works. We're guests on this world. The way we would approach our sense, would we treat furniture the way we do in our own home? No. You would never even think of putting your shoes on someone else's couch, let alone their coffee table. I'm not saying you can't do it in your own home. But if you go through life with the vantage point of saying, I'm just a guest, then you look at things very differently. You're much more aware. You're much more sensitive to what's the appropriate behavior. Yes, you are more than welcome to let your hair down in your own home. I'm not suggesting that you need to be uptight and you need to be really, I mean, if your spouse says it, you should consider it highly, but you know, do you leave as a guest? Do you leave your dirty laundry on the floor? Let's say you're there for a couple of days. You leave the laundry on the floor, right? No, you would never think of it. If you were at least half smart, you would just close the door to your room and then, okay, your mess is your mess. But leave the door wide open and have all your garbage all over the place? You'd never do it. Then why do we do it in our world? Why do we litter? Throw it in the stinking garbage can. It drives me nuts. Turn off the light. How hard is it to turn off the light? Turn the flipping shower handle all the way. You're more careful and sensitive when you're a guest in someone's home, especially if it's somebody that you, you know, prominent. You're much more careful, right? When you leave the bathroom, don't you straighten the towel? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Admit it. I do it. Go through life knowing that we are guests in God's house. You will approach life so much more meaningful. Perhaps, perhaps we can now begin to answer the question I asked you. Why does this parsha end with idol worship? Why does this parsha end about observing Shabbos and having reverence for the sanctuary? Perhaps, and I saw this insight from a Rabbi Avram Steinberg. I think he was a rabbi in Pittsburgh at some point. He makes the following observation, and he quotes it from one of the great sages known as the Netziv. The Netziv. Why is he Netziv? Because that's the acronym of his name. Tully Zvi Yehuda Berlin. That was his name. So the Netziv, in his commentary on the Torah, makes this point. Rashi tells us that this whole concept of idol worshiping, why? We've had this prohibition before. It's the second of the Ten Commandments. We know about idol worshiping. What's this even doing here in the first place? Forget the connection to what our theme is. What's it doing here at all? We've already had this prohibition. So Rashi tells us from the Talmud that this particular case is talking about someone who became so impoverished that not only did he have to sell his land, to sell his home, he had nothing left for himself. He borrowed, he ended up paying interest, which you're not supposed to do. But ultimately, he even had to sell himself into slavery. It's a horrible, horrible situation. His situation was so desperate that he couldn't even sell himself to a fellow Jew. He had to sell himself to a non-Jew, to an idol worshiper. And he finds himself in the home of an idol worshiper. Imagine the scene. I'll play it up, and it's an extreme example, but for entertainment purposes. Imagine you got this guy, a nice, beautiful, black, somewhat salt and pepper beard. Big black kippah. I'm saying somebody, just imagine someone like that. Supposedly he's a good guy, a faithful Jew, observing, he's doing everything. Falls on hard times, and he ends up, you know, he ends up working for the Pope. That's whose house he ends up in. He ends up in the Pope's house, and there's things hanging on the wall. Every room he goes in, he's got people, you know, and every day he's got this going on and this, and praise Jesus that, and praise. I mean, what's a guy supposed to do? I got no problem with that he's fine. He can believe it. But I'm the Jew. What am I going to be doing here? Something's wrong. The Torah tells us, if you view yourself as just a guest, then it doesn't matter what my host is doing. He's doing his thing. But I'm not a slave. I'm not a guest to this host. I'm a guest to God. Everything in this world is God's. Not only the home that I sold, but even the home I'm in now. I don't have to take his ideals. I don't have to take upon myself his practices. I'm a guest in his home. I'm a guest in God's home. Never forget that. The Netziv tells us that it's in this context the Torah tells him should not be influenced by his master's practices. Don't allow that. But it also would explain, therefore, that the Torah warns us about Shabbos and the temple. Why? Because even though he's enslaved by someone who does not respect the Shabbos, who's not someone who particularly is fond of the temple in Jerusalem, doesn't really have even connection to it, the enslaved Jew must remain true to the Torah value and always remember that he is a guest in God's home, anywhere and everywhere. Perhaps this is the idea that the Torah wants to emphasize. I spent an entire parsha telling you about the laws of Shemitah, the laws of the sabbatical year, which means the earth is mine, capital M. It's all mine. And no matter where you go, no matter what situation you find yourself in, you're a guest in my home. Normally, we think of that in the prosperous way, that we need to just keep ourselves in check and not let ourselves get too haughty. But perhaps, suggests the Nitziv, that these last two sentences are coming from the other side. No matter how low you've gone, no matter how far and distant you feel and find yourself in a situation, you're still a guest in God's home. You never sever that connection. You are always, everywhere, a guest in God's home. What a great perspective. If you go through your life understanding that, that I don't have to worship not someone else's idols on one end, or from the arrogant perspective, I should not make myself the idol and think that I did all of this. I'm God. Look what I produced. Either extreme, you are making yourself disconnected from the perspective of being a guest in God's home. That's really the theme. It fits beautifully with this concept about Shemitah. And here's another one. What happens in the Jubilee year? What's one, two of the most important laws regarding the Jubilee years, the year? Anybody?
Land goes back. Land goes back to the original owner.
Excellent. Rule number one is that any land that was sold, an ancestral plot that had been sold sometime during that 50-year period, must return to its original owner. At first glance, from a business perspective, you're like, "Are you kidding? I paid good money for this land. Why would the Torah demand that all those lands go back to their original owners?" Yeah, now you have the ability to answer that question. Because I don't care how much you paid for it, and I don't care how much you used it, it's not yours. Things must go back to their origin. What's the other law of the Jubilee year?
The debts are forgiven.
Good. That's true for Shemitah, not only for the Jubilee. That's true for every seventh year. Debts are canceled.
But you're planting.
What, Arlene?
No planting.
That's true, but that's also for the sabbatical years. The 50th year has another unique law. It only applies in that 50th year.
Is that when if you were a slave, you were free?
Yes. Very good, Michelle. The rule is that normally we say that a person should not make themselves slaves to someone else. In fact, the Torah says that if a Jew has to sell himself into slavery because of his debts, either because he stole and he doesn't have what to pay back, or he just truly is impoverished and he needs to earn, so he, so to say, sells himself into indebted servitude, the Torah says the maximum he could do it is 6 years. Because comes along the seventh year, he should go free. But the Torah says, what if the guy says, "I like it this way? I want to stay in this servitude." So it's not encouraged. It's in fact discouraged in the Torah, but factually it can be done. And the person does stay in that home until when? The most he could do is until the Jubilee year. That's it. At that point, everything must go free. The concept is exactly the same. You as a human being are also a guest, not just the land. You are a guest in God's home. Your body is on loan to you. Your soul is on loan to you. You have no mastery, not of your land, not of your body, not of your soul. You are given custodial rights to make it and improve it and make it the best it can be. But it is never yours. Slaves must go back free. Lands must return to their origin. We need to be reminded of this. I think, and I just want to end with this idea. I think the story that I started with, that Reb Chaim Volozhiner told, is such a sobering thought. If we keep that in mind and we forget sometimes, we should go down when next time you go into your garden or you're right, lay down on the grass. Don't look upwards to the sun. Put your ear to the ground. Everyone's going to think you're nuts. And you say, don't worry, my rabbi said it's okay. Put your ear to the ground and remind, we are guests. We are guests in this world.
Make sure a cicada doesn't crawl in it.
That's true. Don't stay down for too long. But yes, we are guests in his, capital H, house. Yes, Arlene.
When is the next jubilee year?
Great question. The correct answer is it's on hold.
It got corona?
No. No. It's a little complicated, but the laws of Shemitah, the sabbatical year and the jubilee year, although they run in parallel, they are not running on the same circuit. And what I mean by that is the laws of Shemitah, the sabbatical years, are a fixed thing. It's 6 years, the seventh year. 6 years, seventh year. There should be a concurrent calculation because after seven cycles, the jubilee year should kick in. However, for a technical reason, the jubilee year is not actually put in effect unless there is a temple in Jerusalem and the high court, the Supreme Court, announces and declares it such. It's not that we can't figure out when it is. We know what the cycle should be, but it has no relevance because, like I said, it's on hold right now. The sabbatical year is still running. I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, I think next year is a sabbatical year in Israel. I think. If not, it'll be the following. I may be off by one. I don't remember. But it, and I guess let me just spend a minute on that. To this day, in the farmers in Israel are encouraged to participate in this mitzvah. Now you say, well, okay, there's no more manna falling from heaven. How are these people going to survive? I mean, they live, right? I mean, these are farmers. They live on their agriculture. So there is an organization. Seriously, I remember it as a kid. I didn't understand what it was. But as I got older and I learned more about it, it's so smart. This is a biblical mitzvah. The sabbatical year of letting your fields grow fallow is a biblical mitzvah. That's pretty up there. That's more important than you lighting your Hanukkah lamp, just to put it in perspective. And sorry, Alan, it's even more important than drinking on Purim. I'm sorry. It just is. Those are rabbinic. I don't want to downplay it. But the law of Shemitah, that's biblical. So this organization actually spends 6 years collecting money to incentivize farmers to not work their fields. And they give them a stipend. You incentivize. That's how you do it. I've given money to the organization. I think it's a brilliant, first of all, I support the work that they do, but also I now earned a portion of them fulfilling that mitzvah. I don't live in Israel, but they do. I'm helping that farmer fulfill the mitzvah. I get a little credit. You know, after 120 years, I'm going to hopefully go up there and God's going to say, oh, Farmer T, good job. Yeah. At first, I would think it's because I've been out in Frederick long enough that I probably earned the title. But no, I don't know. But it's such a beautiful concept of reminding us every cycle we are guests in God's home. If we take that to heart, like I said before, we would conduct our behavior on a much higher, perhaps classier level. Like the example when you go visit someone prominent in a nice, beautiful, you take it a little more seriously. You're a little more attention to detail. We would do that for everything. You would be so much kinder. You'd be so much more thankful. Gratitude. Thank you for opening up your home. It's so beautiful. Why shouldn't we do that every day? Why shouldn't we do that every time we come into our own homes? Thank you, God, for giving me a beautiful home. Treat it appropriately. It's a gift. We're a guest in God's home. Go through life like that. It's a beautiful world. It really, really is. And therefore, That's the ending, about idol worship, of where you make yourself an idol thinking you did it all. Or even if you end up in a idol worshiping home, you're not far away. You're still a guest in God's home. That's the idea. Any questions?
Rabbi, does anything happen to livestock that you have? Like if you're a shepherd, you're not a farmer, but you farm animals.
Graze. You can't, again, what you're not supposed to do is promote growth.
But no, I meant if you own, you know, a thousand cows or sheep or whatever, are they still yours?
Yes. Yes. You still own. You still have, you know, a stranger can't come into your land and dig up your orange tree and decide to put it somewhere else. They can't come in and decide they want to plant a new tree. It's still technically you have the rights to it, but you can't promote any additional growth. That's really what it is. No one can steal the land from you. But the perspective is why is it so open to everybody? It's because ultimately it's really not mine. Yes, Sharon.
I was going to say, I remember, I don't know if it was with Shorsh or when I was there by myself, but was in Israel during the Shemitah year. And yes, we were very limited on fruits and vegetables and things, but people's perspective that I noticed, and maybe it's just different because it's so wasteful out here, that they were very, very conscious on what they were eating and not wasting anything because it was so limited and everything was so precious to them.
It's funny you say that. I made myself a note. Should I or shouldn't I get it? It's more than that. I don't even know if you realize it's not only because the resources are somewhat limited, but it's more than that. Because a fruit that grows during the sabbatical year has a higher level of sanctity and you can't just throw it away. Things that grow during that sabbatical year, again, you didn't promote growth, but trees still produce. It's not like the trees say, oh, thank God it's the sabbatical. I'm leaving for the year. I'm going down to Aruba. They still produce their oranges. Jaffa oranges are still producing oranges. But if it's grown during the seventh year, it has sanctity of the seventh year. And there are laws about how you can treat it, how you must treat it. And therefore, it wasn't only they were being careful not to waste the leftover core, let's say, from an apple, right? As opposed to the peel of an orange might be different, but the actual fruit, the core of the apple, you can't just throw in the garbage. They would have, if you, next time you go to Israel, God willing, they have special containers that they then let it decompose, what we would call compost. Right. And then, okay, at that point, it loses because it's no longer edible, fine, whatever the laws are. But that's what you're referring to. Their attention to making sure that A, it's not wasted, and B, not disposed of in a not acceptable behavior.
They have special Shemitah trash cans.
Yes, that's exactly right. Because it has a level of sanctity because it grew in that seventh year. It's called Kedushat Shvi'it, the sanctity of the seventh year. And the fruits have a certain extra charge of spirituality. I'm telling you, folks, I couldn't make this stuff up if I tried. Couldn't do it. It's way out of my league.
Well, we're thankful you understand it.
I was just going to say, but thank God I have some level of understanding of the method to the madness. There's plenty more I still need to learn, but at least on some level.
Rabbi, so this is only in Israel, correct?
Yes, the laws of Shemitah only apply in Israel. That is correct.
So, I mean, not that this would happen to everybody, but if somebody had relatives in the United States or could do business dealings in the United States, they could let their land, you know, lay fallow and then still get income from somewhere in the United States, possibly.
No problem. No problem. I will tell you, just so you can have it for your own information, the other mechanism by which the Israeli government deals with this, because it's one thing if you're a religious farmer and you're doing the mitzvah and that you do it your way. But the country needs every piece of wheat that grows. The country needs it. Imagine if every farmer took off. So it's very nice display of faith, but what do? The country won't survive. You got 6 million Jews there now. Not a lot of mouths to feed. Imagine, okay, sorry, all farmers, free vacation, Acapulco, here we go, right? It's big trouble. So one of the things that they do is, and again, it's based on a technical law. It's only applicable if the Jew is the owner of the field. Let's say you have a non-Jew who lives in Israel, plenty of them, and they grow stuff in the land of Israel. Does not fall under the rules of the laws of Shemitah. You are allowed to partake of that. He can sell it. You can buy it. No problem. So what the Israeli government does is that they have an arrangement that large sections of the agricultural part of Israel are sold for the year. You're sold to non-Jews. So everything basically is running as it was the year before, and everyone is able to get the produce and whatever it is they need without violating it. It's called the heter mechira. It's the leniency or the permissibility through sale. It's like you've got a lot of anyone who's an attorney knows that I'm oversimplifying every single law out there. I mean, you write up a contract, it's got umpteen number of details and how it works and when it works and through how and major contracts. But that's one way how they deal with it.
It's like Passover when you're selling.
Correct. That's correct. Correct. It's not mine. That's correct. So those are that's it. So you have a whole group of farmers that don't do anything. They let it grow fallow and it grows. Great. Everybody takes what they want. And then you have many others that they sell it through this mechanism. And then they're working, so to say, for everybody else. But good question, Sharon.
What about in the case, because Israel's in a desert, I mean that there are certain like orchards that if they're not irrigated, they'll die. So is there a line between keeping it alive but not stressing it? And
what makes the orchard grow, Liz?
Rain.
What makes it rain?
Hashem.
Oh, so the same God who knows how to bring rain and make the tree grow with that can also make it grow without it, can he?
But you can like divert irrigation and help to sustain it?
I don't have to. That's God's problem.
Okay.
God will sustain it. In fact, that's, I mean, again, I don't want to go too far off field here, but this is, again, put yourself in year 48 of the 50-year cycle. Year 48. You know that it's at the beginning of 48. You know that this year is the last time that you're going to be planting for 2+ years.
Okay.
Because you're not planting in 49, you're not planting in 50, and you're going to first start planting in 51.
Okay.
So you're like, oh my gosh, we better have a serious bumper crop this year. What are we going to do? If we only produce enough for year 48, so we'll survive for 48, maybe even into 49, but how are we going to survive 50 or into 51?
Okay.
God says, if you think this is my question, Liz, it's actually in the Torah itself. I'll read it to you. And if you were to ask, here, you shall perform my decrees and observe my ordinances and perform them, then you shall dwell securely on the land. The land will give its fruit and you will eat your fill. You will dwell securely upon it. If you will say, I'm reading you from the text of the Torah. This is not my commentary.
Okay.
When that comes out, you'll see totally different language. If you will say, what will we eat in the seventh year? Right? That's what a person's going to say. You don't want me to work. If you would say that, behold, we will not sow and not gather in our crops. I will ordain my blessing for you in the sixth year, and it will yield a crop sufficient for the three-year period.
Wow. Okay.
You will sow in the eighth year, but you will eat from the old crop. You'll still have leftovers.
Okay.
Until the ninth year, until the arrival of its crop, you will eat the old. Which idiot would risk the entire book by making such a promise? Not me. Only the one who can guarantee it.
Okay.
So you're right. I don't know. Things, it may be, Liz, it may be. I don't know the laws of Shemitah inside and out. It may be that things that require maintenance to keep, maybe that's acceptable. I don't remember. I don't recall off the top of my head. But it's not a matter of what am I going to do? How am I going to survive? That is not a question. That the Torah addresses head on and says, God says, I got this.
No, I meant it more like if you don't keep it alive, that it's like wasting it.
Again, it could be that for the maintenance of it, not to promote growth, maybe that's acceptable. I don't know. Don't quote me on this, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know. It could be. Just to maintain so that in year 9, it will produce again.
Right. Okay.
But the point that the Torah, I think, is emphasizing from our perspective is that at some point we put our hands up and say, God, I trust. In God, we truly trust. That's how I will survive it.
Okay. Thank you.
My pleasure. All right. All right. Have a great Shabbos, everybody. Stay healthy. Okay. Stay well. And I'll see you
Shabbos.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Good night, everybody.